Chapter 31. Jonathan Bezaa whipped the blanket free with a magicianly flourish, beaming at Sunday as if this was a moment he had been planning for years. The blanket had concealed a box. It was, superficially, much like the box that Gribelin's proxy had unearthed the day before. The same dimensions, the same grey alloy casing. It looked older, though. Sunday couldn't put her finger on exactly why that should be so. But she knew she was looking at something that had been locked and buried a long time ago. The dents and scratches had provenance.
"I don't understand," she said.
"Eunice came back for my funeral," Jonathan said. "This we know. But she didn't just come back for that. I followed her."
He hesitated, looking aside as if there was shame in what he had done.
"At a distance, obviously, and I don't think she ever suspected anything. It wasn't difficult to track her movements, and there was no Evolverium then. I traced her return to her old landing site near Pavonis Mons, the burial spot."
"You saw her bury the box?" Sunday asked.
He shook his head firmly.
"No, I couldn't get that close, not without making my presence known. But when she'd gone, there was nothing to stop me returning to the landing site. I gave it a year or two just to let the dust settle. Part of me worried that the whole thing was a trap to flush me out."
"But it wasn't."
"No," he agreed. "As much as it pains me, I think I was the last thing on her mind by then. Even my funeral, it suited her to come back to attend it. But maybe she already had other plans."
He trailed off.
"Perhaps you'd better open the box."
"Do you know what's in it?" Jitendra asked.
"Yes, and it's perfectly safe. But it won't talk to me."
As Sunday worked the catches at the side of the box, she said, "I still don't get it. The box Dorcas stole, where did that one come from?"
"Oh, that,"
Jonathan said, as if this was a detail he had nearly allowed to slip his mind.
"I put that there, obviously. I knew that the real box was meant for someone to find, someone connected to the family. For 60 years, no one came. Then Eunice's death was announced, and less than 4 months later, her granddaughter shows up on Mars."
He touched his fingers to his chin, as if mulling a difficult problem.
I wonder if those two things might possibly be connected."
"I was keeping an eye on things for him," Sawyer said. "When it became clear that you intended to enter the Evolverium, there was no doubt that you'd come for the box."
"While Sawyer was meeting you in Cromelin," Jonathan said, "I was out there burying the decoy box. No one saw me do it. With the machine sniffing around, it wouldn't stand a chance of going undetected for more than a few weeks. But we didn't need that long, just the few days it would take you to cross Mars and reach the burial site."
"It was good that I warned you that the pens couldn't necessarily be trusted," Sawyer said. "It meant that you understood the situation the moment Dorcas turned on you. From what we can gather, you played your parts very well indeed. Dorcas never had the slightest idea that she'd been duped."
"She got the wrong box," Jitendra said marvelingly.
"And left you to the mercy of the Evolverium," Sawyer added. "She cut a lot of deals to make that snatch. Frankly, no one will be shedding any tears if the other overfloaters rip the Lady Disdain to shreds."
Sunday had finally succeeded in opening the catches. She eased back the lid, the hinges stiff but manageable. She wasn't sure what to expect this time. There had been a smaller box inside the decoy, but perhaps the point of that had just been to delay the overfloaters. Inside this box, she found a dense matrix of foam packing and a rounded object poking through the top of the packing.
"Take it out," Jonathan said. "It won't bite."
She understood the significance of his comment as she withdrew the ancient space helmet from the box. Even in Martian gravity, it was heavy in her hands. like something forged from iron or cut from solid marble. She had never handled a helmet quite so antiquated, but she had seen it before. Vivid paintwork covered the helmet. Slashes of yellow, gold, and black, daubs of white and red around the visor's rim. The paintwork had chipped to reveal bare metal in places, was scuffed and dirty elsewhere, but the design was still clear. It was a fierce, blue-eyed lioness, her mouth gaping wide around the faceplate.
Senge Dongma, Sunday said, in reverence and awe. The lion-faced one, this is Eunice's actual helmet.
Knew you'd recognize it, Jonathan said.
Sunday bit back the admission that she would have recognized nothing were it not for the construct. I saw an image of it on Phobos, she said. Very recently. Was this really hers?
This is what she buried. It's been in my care ever since.
She turned the helmet around in her hands, wheeling it like a globe, cradling history between her fingertips. In forced exile from her own family, Sunday had handled remarkably few artifacts with a direct link to her grandmother. This helmet, had it been back in the household museum, would have been one of the most hallowed relics. This is all there was? She asked. Nothing else with it?
Were you expecting more? Jonathan responded.
It is just a helmet. The other things we found pointed to something, another burial. This doesn't.
You're sure of that? He asked.
It doesn't take me any further than Mars. I know she had this helmet when she was on Phobos, so she would have brought it down to Mars when the dust storm cleared. But we're on Mars already. It's a dead end.
Unless you are missing something,
Jonathan said.
It's not just a helmet, is it?
Jitendra said.
Is it? I mean, it is a helmet, but that doesn't mean it's just a lump of metal and plastic. There's computing power inside. It will have seen and recorded things while she was using it.
She looked at Jonathan. Have you investigated that?
The helmet is old, Jonathan said. But from a mechanical standpoint, there's nothing wrong with it. It doesn't have an internal power supply of its own, though. It will only work when it's connected to a suit via a compatible neck ring.
Tell her, Sawyer said. Jonathan shot his daughter a tolerant smile.
The suit could be anywhere, if it still exists. Eunice only left the helmet here, at this particular burial site. But it doesn't have to be the same suit to make the helmet work. It just has to fit.
You'd still have to find an old suit, Jitendra said. That's what antiques markets are for, Sawyer said, with a glimmer of pride. It took me a long, long time, but I found one in the end, not far from Lowell. Not as old as the helmet, only about 70 years, but with the same coupling. She whisked aside one of the room's curtains, revealing an old-fashioned composite shell spacesuit, olive drab and grey, with evidence of damage and repair all over it. The suit was complete from the neck ring down, hanging from a rack that had been bolted to the metal innards of the aggregate.
It's a piece of shit, Sawyer explained. You'd trust your life to this thing only if it were the absolute last resort, but it can still juice the helmet.
Sunday asked the obvious question. Have either of you tried it on?
Both of us, Jonathan answered. Some kind of low-level sphinx were running inside it. Beyond a few gatekeeper questions, it won't talk to either of us. But it might work for you.
There was no part of getting into that musty old suit that Sunday could be said to have enjoyed. The suit was a poor fit in all the critical places. It felt as if it had been tailored for a portly child, not a woman, and being 70 years old, it did nothing to assist in the process of being worn. Without the complicity of Jitendra, Jonathan, and Sawyer, she doubted she would have been able to put the hideous old thing on at all. Conversely, without them there, she probably wouldn't have had the nerve to keep trying. Each component of the suit, as it clicked into place, added to her sense of imprisonment and paralysis. The suit was not functioning, in any accepted sense of the word. Its motive power assist was dead, so it required all of Sunday's strength and determination to move it even slightly. The best she could manage was a ghoulish, mummy-like shuffle, and the effort of that would soon tax her to exhaustion. Not that she could go very far anyway. Its cooling and air recirculation systems were only barely operative, so it was as hot and stuffy as the inside of a sleeping bag. It had no independent internal power supply, but needed to be connected to the aggregate by an energy umbilical. Only then could the suit feed power to the helmet, which had to be locked in place before it would boot up and function. Sunday felt ready to be buried. The air circulator huffed and wheezed like an asthmatic dog. Caution indicators, blocked in red, were already illuminating the faceplate head-up display. Even before it had fully booted, the helmet knew that it was plugged into a piece of barely safe garbage, and it wasn't too happy about it.
"The current user is not recognized," the helmet said, its waspish buzzing into her ears in Swahili. "Please identify yourself."
With an assertiveness that rather surprised herself, she declared, "I am Sunday Akinya." The helmet went quiet for a few seconds, as if it was thinking things over.
"Please state your relationship to Eunice Akinya." "I'm her granddaughter. I've come to Mars for this helmet. Please recognize my authority to wear it." "What brought you to Mars?"
She had to think about that, sensing that the suit might be looking for a very specific answer.
"Something I found in Phobos," she said cautiously.
"What did you find in Phobos?"
"A painting."
She took a breath, feeling sweat prickle her forehead.
"A mural. There was a mistake, an alteration. The peacock should have been a different bird. A crane, maybe an ibis."
"What brought you to Phobos?"
Had she passed the first test or merely skipped to the next question, having failed the first one? The suit gave no clue.
"Pages from a book," Sunday said, swallowing hard. "Gulliver's Travels. It was a clear reference to the moons of Mars, and Eunice had only ever spent time on Phobos, so that had to be the right moon."
Through the helmet glass, which was beginning to mist up, Jitendra and the others were watching her with avid interest. They were ready to spring to her aid should something go wrong with the life support system, but knowing that didn't alleviate Sunday's sense of confinement.
"I found the pages on the moon, Earth's moon," she added, "in the crater Pythagoras."
"What led you to Pythagoras?"
"A glove which we found in a safe deposit box also on the moon. The glove used to belong to Eunice Akinya. There were gems in the glove, plastic gems, three different colors. The numbers corresponded to a Pythagorean triple. Knowing Eunice's history, we were able to pinpoint a crash site in the crater."
She felt as if she was going to faint.
"That's all I've got. The existence of the safe deposit box came from an audit of Eunice's affairs after her death."
"What was the significance of the colored gems?"
"The colors had no significance."
But why would the helmet have asked her if the answer was so simple?
"Except they had to be different colors so that we could count them."
That was what Jitendra had said, at least, and she'd been more than ready to accept the explanation. But the gems had been stuffed into different fingers. Given the care they'd taken with the examination, they'd have been unlikely to muddle them up.
"You have failed to pass all security questions," the helmet said. "Nonetheless, you are recognized as having the necessary authority. Please wait."
"Please wait for what?"
"Please wait."
Even through the fogging glass, Jitendra must have seen the doubt in her eyes. He pushed his face close to the visor.
"What's happening?"
he asked, voice muffled as if many rooms away.
"It asked me a bunch of questions,"
she shouted back, making herself feel lighter-headed in the process.
"I failed at least one of them, but it's accepting me anyway. Can you crank up the cooling on this thing? It's like a Turkish bath in here."
Jitendra and Jonathan exchanged words.
Sawyer nodded and went to one side, out of Sunday's field of view. A moment later, she felt knocking and tapping as Sawyer fiddled with the suit's backpack. The faceplate continued to fog over, even as the air grew fractionally cooler than it had been before. Sunday wondered whether it was better to close her eyes than confront that misted over glass only centimeters from her nose and mouth. Then the mist began to clear. But just when the condensation had shrunk back almost completely around the faceplate's borders, it grayed over again. Sunday was about to call to Jitendra when she realized the grayness wasn't more condensation. Rather, it had been caused by the head-up display obstructing her entire forward view. The head-up view was changing now, but the image that resolved wasn't the room inside the aggregate. What she could see was a broken aeroplane. It lay upside down, snapped wings scissored across its fuselage. Dust had gathered in its lee. The plane slumped on the crest of a gently sloping ridge, bone white, against a horizon of darkening butterscotch. More dust spilt from the ruptured eye of its bubble canopy. Sunday thought of her brother, that this was some dire vision of the Cessna crashed and upended. But this was not Jeffrey's aircraft. To the right of the wreck, 100 paces further up the shallow incline, sat a squat compound of pressure-tight huts. The huts' rib-sided shells had been scoured to a grey metal sheen by dust storms. Dust had also built up in their wind shadows. Faded almost to illegibility was a hammer and sickle flag. A wind gauge, its cups as large as wash basins, whirred atop the roof of the largest hut. Sunday found her point of view moving towards the aircraft, acting independently of her own volition. Her line of sight dipped, as if she was kneeling to peer into the inverted bulge of the shattered canopy. The seat was upside down, the buckled harness dangling open where it had been released. The cockpit was empty. Her point of view turned from the aircraft again without her direction, and approached the cluster of huts. The significance of the weather station and the smashed aeroplane was unavoidable. It was here, on the slopes of Pavonis Mons, that Eunice had landed and then sought shelter during a particularly ferocious storm. The plane had been intact when she brought it down, but had subsequently been plucked from its moorings by the winds, upended and crushed like a paper toy. The station and plane were gone now, but the documented fact of this episode had been the only thing pointing to a specific part of the terrain around the Martian volcano. Sunday already knew this. She could not have found the helmet without already making this connection. So what did Eunice want with her now? Metal steps, the lower treads buried in dust, led to the airlock in the largest of the Russian huts. The outer door and its interior compartment were both open. Sunday's point of view ascended the steps. Inside, it was brightly lit and wrong. Physics and common sense were in dreamlike abeyance. It was not the interior of a Russian weather station on Mars, but an annex of the household. The light blazed in through square windows at a steep slant. It fell on recognizable furniture. Chairs and tables, rugs and hangings, white plastered walls. There were ornaments on the tables. Dust glints trembled in the air. In place of one wall, silk curtains billowed. Sunday would have been drawn to the curtains even if she had control of the suit's point of view. A gloved hand reached out and parted the curtains. She pushed on through. Outside, it was Africa. It was somewhere near dusk, some season when the skies held an abundance of clouds, gaudy with underlit colours, salmon pink, vermilion, rare shades of rose and tangerine. Between the clouds, improbably, the slashes of clear sky were luminous cobalt. The trees, darkly silhouetted, reminded her of toy theatre cutouts. The view tracked around. Kilimanjaro slid into sight, snowless. The household, blue-tiled and white-plastered, the walls reflecting sky in 100 pastel combinations. A flight of cranes, like birds in a Chinese watercolor. A stand of trees, more solid and real-looking than the silhouettes. Her point of view commenced towards that place of shelter, and the woman who had been leaning with her back against one of the trees, sitting down as she read in the last light of some long-gone day, made to stand up, neither hurriedly, as if she'd been disturbed, nor languidly, as if she had all the time in the world, as if this was simply the ordained moment. The figure rested one hand on her hip. The other grasped the book she had been reading, resting against her thigh. She wore riding pants and boots, and a white blouse with the sleeves rolled up to bony elbows. The blouse looked very much like the one Sawyer had been wearing.
"Good evening, Sunday," the woman said.
"How do you know my name?" Sunday asked, wondering what she was dealing with.
"You told me just now when you answered the helmet's questions. Do you understand what I am?"
"Not really.
When I buried this helmet on Mars, it was already 40 years old. I had its systems upgraded as best I could, but there were still limitations to what could be achieved. You are not interacting with Eunice Akinya, rather with a very simple model of her, with a limited range of responses and a very restricted internal knowledge base. Don't go mistaking it for me."
"So, this is you speaking now?"
"This is an interactive recording, a message to you, whoever you may be. The Sphinx Ware wouldn't have admitted you unless you'd uncovered the trail that led to this point, so the chances are excellent that you're a member of the family, or at least someone with close ties to it."
"As you just said, I've told you who I am."
"You have, and we shall proceed on that basis."
Eunice, the recording of Eunice, glanced down at the book she'd been reading.
"Firstly, you've done well to come this far. That took resourcefulness. I trust there were no particular unpleasantnesses along the way?"
"You could have picked a better burial site on Mars." Eunice's eyes sharpened.
"There were local difficulties."
"This is the middle of the fucking Evolvarium, Grandmother."
"I have no idea what you are talking about. Evil what? Succinctly, please."
"Other than burying your helmet in a minefield, you couldn't have picked a worse spot on Mars. This whole area, for 1,000 kilometers in any direction, is a no-go zone. It's a place where self-replicating machines are allowed to run riot. They evolve through generations, fighting for survival. Every now and then, that evolutionary process throws up some gimmick, some idea or gadget that someone can make money from outside the Varium. The machines are dangerous, and the people who run the place don't take kindly to outsiders poking around. Our guide was killed out there, and Jitendra and I came close to dying as well."
"I'm sorry."
The contrition sounded genuine.
"I meant you to be challenged, but not put in real peril. Still, I can't be held accountable for what happened to Mars after the burial."
Again, there was that sharpening of her gaze.
"It's an odd thing to happen, though. This is the only place like it on Mars."
"I told you, you couldn't have picked a worse location."
"Then that's strange. I'm not one for coincidences, Sunday. Not this kind, anyway." "There must be an explanation."
"You tell me."
"I only know what I know, but how could my little adventure on Pavonis Mons have led to this?"
She gave every impression of thinking about that, reopening the book and leafing through it, scratching her fingernails against the fine, Bible-thin paper, even though her eyes were not on the close-printed text.
"After I lost the aeroplane, but no."
A quick dismissive headshake.
"That can't be it."
"What can't be what?"
"I had to take shelter while the storm raged. The Russian station was still airtight, and it had power and the basic amenities. But I couldn't stay there forever. The wind had damaged the aircraft, but I still needed a way out."
Sunday issued a terse, "Continue," as if Eunice needed permission.
"The Russians had left a lot of equipment in their station. some of it still semi-functional. Before landing, I'd scouted a number of abandoned facilities and assets in the area. If I could salvage some of that junk, I'd be able to keep myself alive longer. Batteries, air scrubbers, that kind of thing. Maybe even rig up some kind of repair to the aircraft. But I couldn't go out there. My suit wasn't stormproof. And in any case, it only had a limited range. I couldn't have walked far enough to do any good. So you were in deep shit. Until I found the robots. Eunice snapped the book shut again. The Russians had left them behind, in one of the storage sheds. I'm not surprised. They were old, slow, their programming screwed. Still, I didn't need them to do much for me. She smiled quickly, as if abashed at her own resourcefulness. I patched them together, fixed their programming as best as I could. Took me 8 days, but it kept my mind off the worst. Then I sent them out in different directions. Running on maximum autonomy, I told them to locate anything that looked potentially useful and drag it back to me. I guess it worked. No, rescue came sooner than I anticipated. The storm cleared, and my people were able to get me out. As for the robots, I forgot about them. But they were still out there, running with my flashed-up programming. They were supposed to take care of themselves and to act competitively if the need arose.
Do I think you inadvertently created the Evolvarium? I'd say yes, if I wasn't worried that your ego might already be on the point of stellar collapse.
Eunice dislodged a fly from her brow.
I've achieved enough by intent without dwelling on things I made happen by accident. Regardless, I'm truly sorry if circumstances were more complicated than I envisaged. But it appears you weathered the adversity. Congratulations, Sunday. You've come through very well.
My brother and I have been sharing the burden. And does that mean you have the full authority of the family behind you?
I wouldn't go that far, no. I never counted on it. The important thing is that you've demonstrated the necessary insight and determination to make it this far.
Eunice lifted her head to study the sun.
My internal clock tells me that more than 60 years have passed since the barrier. Is that really the case?
Yes, Sunday said. And you've only just died. The reason I'm here is because of an audit the household ran just after your death.
A long time in anyone's book. How have things been while I was gone?
With the family?
Everything. The world, the flesh, and the devil. Us. Have we managed not to screw things up completely?
I'm here, Sunday said. That should tell you something, shouldn't it?
I was born in 2030, Eunice said. People told me it was the best and worst of times. To me, it just seemed like the way of the world. Whether you're born with famine in your belly or a silver spoon in your mouth, it's always just the way things are, isn't it? You know no different. Later, I realized I was fortunate, extraordinarily so. Fortunate to have been born African, for one thing, in the right place at the right time. My mother and father always said we should make the best of things, so that's what we did. The world still had some catching up to do, mind. I grew up with the last wars ever fought on Earth. They never touched me directly, but no one could entirely escape their influence. Please tell me they were the last wars. I couldn't bear to think we'd slipped back into our bad old ways.
There haven't been any more wars, which is not to say things are perfect back on Earth. I tease my brother about it often enough. They still have police, armies, and peacekeeping forces, the occasional border incident, but it's not like it used to be.
The resource and relocation crisis taught us to grow up, Eunice said. We were like a house full of squabbling children for most of our history. And then the house started burning down. We had to grow up fast or burn with it.
We did.
What is it like out there now? Have you seen much of the system?
Not much. I was born on Earth, but I've spent most of my adult life on the moon. This is the first time I've ever been anywhere else.
You never had the means?
It's complicated.
Sunday nodded at the book her interlocutor was holding.
Is that Gulliver's Travels?
Eunice glanced absent-mindedly at the title.
Finnegan's Wake, she said. I liked Swift when I was little. Maybe Gulliver turned me into an explorer, but this is denser. I still haven't got to the bottom of it. So many questions. You could spend a lifetime on it and still not understand it.
She flicked open a random page, frowned at something written in there.
Who was Muster Mark? And what do you suppose he wanted with 3 quarks?
I don't know.
Sunday was ready to leave the suit now.
What's this all about, Eunice? Why did you bury the helmet? Why are you asking me these things?
You disappoint me, Sunday. To have so much of the world ready for the taking and to have seen so little of it. I thought Wanderlust ran in our blood. I thought it was the fire that made us Akinyas.
You saw it all and then you came back. A sad old woman with no interest in anything except money and power and lording it over the rest of us. Doesn't that suggest all that exploring was really just a waste of time?
It would, if it hadn't changed me.
The book's leather binding offered a creak of complaint as she shut it.
I've seen marvelous things, Sunday. I've looked back from the edge of the system and seen this planet, this Earth, reduced to a tiny dot of pale blue. I know what that feels like. To think that dot is where we came from, where we evolved out of the dirt and chaos. To think that Africa is only a part of that dot, that the dot contains not just Africa, but all the other continents, the oceans, the ice caps, under a kiss of atmosphere, like morning dew, soon to be boiled off in the day's heat. And I know what it feels like to imagine going further, to hold that incredible, dangerous thought in my mind, if only for an instant, to think, what if I don't go home? What if I just keep on traveling, watching that pale blue dot fall ever further away until the darkness swallowed it, and there was no turning back, until Earth was just a blue memory?
Sunday's scorn was overwhelming.
You never had the nerve. Maybe not, but at least,
Eunice answered mildly,
I've stood on the edge of that cliff and thought about jumping.
I came to Mars. Isn't that adventurous enough for you?
You've only taken baby steps, child. But I can't fault your determination. After all, you found me.
Yes, and where has that got me?
To this point. And I'm not done with you yet, not by a long mark. There's a choice that needs to be made, a difficult one. And in all conscience, I just don't have the mental capacity to make it.
That's uncharacteristically modest of you.
Oh, I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about this thing I've become, this bundle of clanking routines stuffed into a 100-year-old space helmet. That won't suffice, not when so much is at stake. That's why I'm going to leave matters in your hands. Return to lunar space. Go to the Winter Palace, if it's still there. It is. If you've managed to find the helmet, then you'll get past the Sphinxware guarding the palace. And if you are, as you say, Akinya, then the rest will follow.
She paused.
At some point you'll be challenged by more Sphinxware. The answer you give will be critical. But I can't tell you what that answer should be. I've been buried under Mars for 60 years.
And that's meant to be helpful? How exactly? Her eyes twinkled.
Forewarned is forearmed.
Thank you, Sunday said, drenching her answer in as much sarcasm as she could muster.
I wish I could tell you more, but the simple fact is that I only know the things I need to know here and now. Yet, wisely or otherwise, I have faith in you, Sunday Akinya.
You just told me you're a bunch of routines stuffed into a helmet. How could you possibly know whether I'm up to the task?
Because you remind me of me,
Eunice said. You mean up my arse with my own divine self-importance?
It's a step in the right direction.
Sunday took deep and grateful gulps of air. Her clothes were soaked in sweat, sticking to her as she was extricated from the suit.
I hope that wasn't too traumatic,
Jonathan said, pushing a glass into Sunday's clammy hand. You've had the helmet all this time, yet in 60 years you never figured out a way to break through the Sphinx wear? She drank the glass down in one go. Even if you couldn't do it, surely someone else would have been able to.
There might have been a way, Jonathan said. But would the risk have been worth it? If the helmet sensed it was being hacked, it might have erased its contents. Besides, it didn't really interest me.
I can't believe that.
You have to remember that I was the one who bored your grandmother. When she'd grown restless of Mars, I was happy to put down roots. The helmet was from that other part of her life, the part I had nothing to do with.
Sawyer dabbed Sunday's forehead with a cloth.
Then why dig it up? Sunday asked.
I still wanted to make sure it reached the right hands. If that meant acting as curator, so be it. If I hadn't, the machines would have recycled it decades ago.
You can't argue with that, Sawyer said. No, but I'm not sure what either of us has achieved. Yes, there was a message from Eunice in the helmet, and it told me some stuff, but answers? All she gave me was some cryptic horse piss about something being a blessing or a curse. She wouldn't say which, other than that I need to get to the Winter Palace, which is back where I started.
She dragged you all this way to Mars to tell you the answer is on your doorstep?
Jitendra asked.
I don't know what she was telling me.
Sunday accepted another glass of water from Jonathan. She was beginning to feel human again, save for the lingering aches and pains where the suit had been squeezing her. There was some stuff about looking back at Earth, seeing it from all the way out. She paused and said doubtfully, maybe there's more it can tell me.
You want to get back in that thing?
Jitendra asked, with what struck her as a particularly touching concern for her well-being.
Maybe. When we're back in Orgreach, the construct can find a way in without tripping the Sphinx wear to self-erase. But we have to leave the Evolvarium for that. She thinks she might have created this place, by the way, by accident.
She was here, Jitendra admitted. No one can argue with that. And when all this is over, someone really needs to dig around and find out how the Evolvarium got started. Maybe I'll do it.
You'll ruffle a few feathers,
Sawyer said.
Good. It's about time.
That'll have to wait, I'm afraid, Sunday said. I need to get a message to Jeffrey very urgently. Even if I left Mars right now, I'm still more than a month from home. That's too long. One of us needs to look inside the Winter Palace before Hector or Lucas gets the same idea.
You can reach Vishniak by tomorrow morning,
Sawyer said.
Cross the Evolvarium at night.
It's safer when you have friends in the right places,
Jonathan said. There was a gleam in his eyes that didn't belong in a man that old.
Trust Sawyer. She'll get you back in one piece. But promise me something. This won't be the last time we speak, will it?
We've barely begun,
Sunday said.
Count on it, Jitendra said. Even if she doesn't come back, I will. I'm serious about ruffling those feathers, and I have a feeling there's a lot you and I could talk about.
I think so too, Jonathan said.
Then he frowned slightly, turning back to Sunday.
What you said just now about it all being horse piss.
What? Sunday asked.
Please don't take this the wrong way,
but you sounded just like your grandmother.